It's hard to believe that this year marks the 40th anniversary of the Steppenwolf Theater. One of Chicago's greatest companies, the Steppenwolf has been home to such amazing theater artists. Everyone from Gary Sinise and Jeff Perry, John Mahoney and Laurie Metcalf, Terry Kinney, John Malkovich, Rondé Reed. I mean, the list is truly forever. And the actors, they went from fearless ensemble to venerable institution. And now they're telling their story through author John Mayer. Mayer wrote the book Steppenwolf Theater Company of Chicago in their own words, and he joins me tonight. John, thanks for being here. Nice to see you.
It is my pleasure to be here in the humidity of Chicago coming from California. So,
what struck me about this is it's a great book about Steppenwolf, and like you said, it's through their words. How did you go about making this happen to get all of these actors to be able to tell stories about their theater?
Well, it started about a little over 25 years ago. When I wrote my dissertation on Steppenwolf Theater Company to get my doctorate, I had grown up with Gary Sinise and Jeff Perry, so I was intimately connected to the company. And then it kind of fell on the back burner for years while I pursued my career in academia. And then out of the blue, a couple of years ago, I got an email from a woman who worked with the publishing house Methuen Drama in London. They're a subsidiary of Bloomsbury, which does the Harry Potter books.
Oh, okay.
And she asked me if I wanted to write a book on Steppenwolf. So I thought, well, the time is right. The time is now. And I'm ready.
Right?
I'm ready. I only used maybe about 15% of the dissertation, though. So it's a whole new book.
For you, I mean, obviously, you know, doing a dissertation on the theater company and writing this book, Steppenwolf has a big part. You know, you have a big part of, you understand Steppenwolf pretty well. Talk about the beginning of the company, because you say you grew up with Gary and Jeff, but talk about the roots, because it's one of the idyllic stories of Chicago theater, this sort of Highland Park or, you know, bouncing off the walls, basement of a church. How much of that is reality? How much of that is true?
It's real. Gary, Jeff, and I all went to high school together in the early 70s and did shows together in high school. We had an amazing, amazing woman who mentored us. Her name was Mrs. Greener to us. Her name's Barbara Greener Patterson now. She was a force of nature who literally, I wrote an article that I never worked to get published because I got into the book, but it was my high school teacher changed the face of the American theater, and I believe she did. She was a dynamo, and we lived and breathed theater 24 hours a day,
wow.
7 days a week in high school. Gary was hanging out in a area of Highland Park High School we called the Glass Hall. It was basically back in the early 70s where the quote-unquote freaks hung out. And Barbara Greener was walking down the hallway one day, and she was in the process of trying to come up with auditions and casting for West Side Story. She saw Gary sitting in the Glass Hall. She went up to him and she said, "You know, you look kind of like a gang member. Why don't you come out and audition for this play?" And Gary literally just hung out and, you know, had no pathway. He did music and whatever. And he went out to auditions, and his life transformed overnight. And from that moment on, his destiny was clear.
You know, to understand, hey, I want to be in this. I want to be an actor. I want to do this thing. I have an unbelievable teacher to make this happen. That's one thing. But to create a theater and to find like-minded people and come together to be able to bring American classics to life and really commit to an ensemble, that's something different.
We were taught the power of ensemble by this teacher. It was interesting when I was interviewing people, and it was kind of new to me. I interviewed our mentor first, Barbara Greener. It was like I knew I had to do that. She lives down in Nashville. She lives in the same building as Dolly Parton. She's 85 years old, and she's still full of fire and still full of that passion. And I hadn't really gotten accustomed to interviewing. And instead of just like putting my tape recorder down and taping her for an hour, I ended up breaking it up into 9 sections just because I was a little unclear. I sent all those sections out and a couple of other interviews out to the transcribing company I was using. And the very first piece of transcription that came back to me, miraculously, I might add, was 1 minute that she had told a story, and it's at the beginning of the book. And she tells the story because when growing up in the 30s and 40s, her mother had been an acting teacher. So she grew up around a theatrical family. And she said, "I called my mother at the studio, and I said, 'Mama, Sally set the house on fire.' And my mama said, 'Well, you better get a bucket.' And she hung up." And that is essentially what she taught us. Figure it out. And so we were all in a directing class together, Jeff and Gary and I, in high school, a directing class in high school. Take a minute to think about that, where our final project was supposed to be a one-act play, but everybody just went off and directed plays. So my junior year of high school, I was in four plays at one time. It was like being in summer stock. Right. And Gary and Jeff decided to do a play in a portion of the student cafeteria, and they literally built a theater in the round. You know, got coffee cans and fixed lights, and then they talked to the school about arranging some seating. About 2 years later, after we graduated, they actually turned that space into a theater in the round. So we were always creating spaces. We did plays anywhere and everywhere. And that idea of getting the mop just became kind of, for me, the story of Steppenwolf.
Well, I think about that's so interesting, because I think about, you know, in the middle of the book, I think it was Laurie Metcalf talking about how everybody had to do everything. It was done by committee. And that's what a true ensemble, when we talk about ensemble theater, it's not just about, you know, they can work well together on stage, but it's almost by rule. You know, there's some of the greatest companies of our time, and I think in comedy this is true with Second City, but also with Upright Citizens Brigade has told this story, that it's all for one in the sense that, you know, decisions are made in committee. I mean, that's so the idea. So,
and they lived in isolation too. I mean, up in Highland Park, they were isolated. They didn't go see anything. They were working full-time jobs, and then they were spending every waking hour at the theater, creating the space, painting the floors, cleaning the bathrooms, and they did everything. So they went through that incredible bonding experience that most theater companies can't go through. And they were young and naive. I mean, we were literally just out of high school. We did three shows in high school under the name of Steppenwolf. So we had started this thing when we were 17, 18, 19 years old.
When did Steppenwolf move from just straight up creative energy of guys like yourself and Jeff and Gary to something more legitimate, something more real?
Well, it was a building block process. And of course, early in their days, they rejected the whole concept of institution. They would have dreaded the thought that they might actually have become one. Of course, they are now one of the arguably the most successful theatrical institution in town, along with the Goodman and Second City. I mean, they're the kind of pillars. But they rejected that. They started to get some notoriety.
Why did they reject that? I mean, it's interesting because I kind of set it up in the intro, this idea that they were fearless ensemble members to venerable institution. What was it about being an ensemble that and being a part of the early days of Steppenwolf that they didn't want to move into the sort of what they are now?
I'd say conjecture on my part, but I think they just felt like if they became an institution somehow, they would lose control. You know, you would have a board, you would have other people influencing all their decision
making. And that's not what they were in for. They were in to act.
They just wanted to do great parts. Wanted to do great parts. They weren't looking to the future. Let's do that play because there's a great part in there for me and a great part in there for me, and you could direct this, and it was just spontaneous. So I think they feared that becoming an institution, and they never really thought about becoming an institution, it just kind of happened, that would somehow put something negative into what they had created.
So back to that question, when did it get real? What was the moment where Steppenwolf went from Highland Park, you know, sort of basement to sort of national notoriety?
Well, I'd say the pivotal production for them that really thrust them into, and there were a couple things before that started to get them attention, was Bauman-Gilead, end of 1980-81. It was a miraculous show. Anybody who's seen it or experienced it will never be the same. In fact, I'm directing it at my university, California State University Stanislaus, this fall, and Kevin Rigdon, who was the original set and lighting designer, is actually designing our production, which is cool. When they did that show, there's a great story in the book. Fran Guinan is standing on stage before opening night with John Malkovich, and nobody's around, and they're standing there, and Fran said, so I looked at John, and I said, so what do you think, man? You know, you think this is going to happen? And John was smoking a cigarette. He just kind of looked back at me and went, I don't know. And he said the show opened, and the next morning when the reviews came out, it was like a national holiday. I mean, Baum and Gilead was transformative. Subsequently, a few years later, they took the show to Circle Rep in New York. They had taken then True West to New York, which was an overnight success, turned John Malkovich into a star, started his film career. They took Waiting for the Parade, another play that they had done with Joan Allen and Moira Harris. And
this was all sort of early to mid-'80s.
Early 80s, right. Yeah. And so over that 2 or 3 year period, they went from, you know, basically 5-6 years out of Highland Park into the national spotlight.
And it's, I mean, True West is the, what I think, when I think of Steppenwolf, I think of that play. I mean, that was something that, was that Malkovich and Sinise at the, in that role?
It was, and Gary directed it. And it was the first show they took to New York.
Yeah.
And it was a real pivotal time in the theater because a lot of people in the theater, for the, some of the same reasons we were just talking about with regards to institution, they didn't want to take the play to New York. A big portion of the ensemble, because they were afraid that if they went to New York, that that might be the end of the company. If success came or whatever, they'd lose members. And it was a really pivotal time.
That's an important distinction to make, because they're not the only company that's grappled with that. There's a big part of the Second City history about going to Broadway. And they lost the Mike Nichols and Elaine Mays left Second
City. Saturday Night Live.
Saturday Night Live. There was so much about that push and pull when it comes to theater in this town about should I stay and should I go.
Yeah, John and Gary were pretty much committed to making it happen, and ultimately they were right. Gary was right. Gary was the driver of that train, and they were right. And actually, the added attention and luster is what then catapulted Steppenwolf to the next level, you know, and brought them power and control in a way that they thought they might lose. They actually gained, you know, because they had more resources and attention.
They've had so many great people that have come through there. And to fast forward, you know, decades to August Osage County, which is, you know, one of the biggest hits in Chicago and Broadway.
And you've never seen it?
I've never seen it. But Deanna Dunnigan's been on this program, and she's
wonderful. She's awesome. She's amazing. One of the great things about doing this was meeting somebody like Deanna Dunnigan and be able to hang out with her. She's
The thing about it is that this theater continues to thrive. I mean, having Tracy Letts involved, having the ensemble members that are now. I mean, it's interesting to watch how this book talks about it, but also just how the rebirth of a company. The company doesn't just live and die with the first five people that were in the Highland Park, you know, basement. This is a company that has found other like-minded individuals and ensemble members and actors in this area to continue the legacy.
Yeah, I mean, there's 46 ensemble members. We're talking about a company that started with 9. And I didn't mean to call you on your lack
okay.
of seeing August Osage County. You missed it.
In, right?
Hopefully you'll get another chance.
Get the old time warp.
Yeah, no, I think the company, and particularly under the leadership of their new artistic director, Anna Shapiro, you know, is really poised to take the theater to a whole new place. Martha Levy did a, you know, I don't even think anybody could put into the words the impact she had on the theater with her tenure as artistic director. And I think Anna is now poised to take this even to even greater heights. And there's amazing things going on. I mean, they just built a new theater at the facility. There's a bar there. They're bringing back some of the people who have gone on to success who can now come in and do a show for a couple of weeks. Laurie Metcalf, John Hill. It's really exciting what's going on at Steppenwolf.
You
right
know,
now.
For you to have had this relationship with Steppenwolf, to have the dissertation that you did, to write the book about the company. What does Steppenwolf mean to you? When it's all done and you've done all this work and you put all this research into it and you've been able to be a vessel for the stories of these artists, for you, what does it mean?
Well, you know, I follow the John Steinbeck quote. And that is from Travels with Charlie. He says, you don't take a trip takes you. And somehow I gave myself up to the forces of the outside, and I ended up right where I'm supposed to be. I'm the chair of a theater department. I work at a university teaching. None of that would have happened without my connection to Steppenwolf and Second City and the training of, and being a Chicagoan and appreciating the work. Because that's the bottom line at Steppenwolf. I think that's true at Second City as well. It's the work. It's not about being successful. It's not about making a lot of money. Those things are nice. But it's about focusing on making the work as strong and clear and telling the story as best you can. And, you know, that's what I strive for in my life because of my connection to Steppenwolf, dating back to our high school teacher.
Another lesson on what makes Chicago, Chicago, here from John Mayer. He's the author of Steppenwolf Theater Company of Chicago in their own words. It's a book that looks at the history of this great theater company, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary through the words and stories of the ensemble members that have been involved. John, thanks for being in, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been great to be here.